From the stuff your mother never told you to the stuff your doctor never learned, On Health is what happens when a midwife plus a Yale-trained MD shares about all things women's health, from periods to menopause, sex to reproductive health politics, motherhood to mental health. Join me for taboo-busting conversations that demystify and destigmatize our bodies, all while bridging the gap between conventional medicine and wellness. Along the way, we'll be exploring the science and wisdom of how our bodies work, what makes us well, what gets in the way, and how we can live our best lives on our terms. When it comes to women's health and well-being, there's nothing we won't talk about. The new medicine for women is here. I'm Dr. Aviva Ram. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome, everyone, to today's On Health episode. We're going to be confronting a fairly heart-wrenching challenge that's under-discussed but faced by women worldwide, and particularly in many African nations. And this is the devastating condition of obstetric fistula. I have seen women who have come from countries where they have had fistulas and minimal opportunity for repair, and the impact on women's lives is devastating. I first saw the impactful film Walk to Beautiful, which I highly encourage everyone to watch, when it aired in 2007, and I was utterly jaw-dropped by the stark realities it presented. This condition is often caused by prolonged obstructed labor without access to timely medical intervention, and affects over 2 million women worldwide. And it leads not only to chronic infections and incontinence, but those in turn lead to medical issues that women live with, like odor resulting from urinary and fecal incontinence, ulcers on their genitals, their buttocks, and their legs. But also, and perhaps maybe even more devastating, I can't speak for these women, but certainly my guest today will be able to represent what's really happening, is this deep level of shame and devastating social and cultural ostracization. So my guest today, Bonnie Reuter, will join me to explore the personal stories of resilience and the ongoing battle, if you will. And I don't use that word lightly because I tend to stay away from military language, but it really is. It's such a challenge against obstetric fistula and the triumphs and enduring struggles of these really courageous women. Bonnie is a medical anthropologist, a licensed home birth midwife with over 20 years experience, the mom of two boys and two stepdaughters, and she's the co-founder and executive director of Tara Woad Women's Fund, a U.S.-based nonprofit whose mission is to end obstetric fistula and other childbirth injuries in Uganda through long-term partnerships in the local community, and through NGOs and other agencies in the region, and by supporting holistic treatment and access to safe childbirth education and services. And I just want to say that as so many aspects of my life have unfolded, whether it's my online community or my teaching or my medical practice, I didn't expect the deep level of women relationships and friendships that would come into my life through the On Health podcast. And one of those is with a woman named Julie Kay. I've interviewed Julie, and she is an incredible reproductive justice attorney. And now she's brought Bonnie into my life and into the On Health community. And Bonnie, I'm just so grateful for you and delighted to have a sister midwife here to talk with today. So thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you. I'm actually so grateful to talk to you. I've followed you for years. When I was training to be a midwife, I read your books, and then I followed your journey as you became an MD and started writing about women's health and thyroid. And so it's really an honor, yeah, to be here.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for saying that. It's really, it's funny, like people think, oh, you get to a point in your life and you're like, you're there. But I feel like I'm always evolving, and it's really nice to hear. Like, it's a reminder for me to also just like, oh, keep owning the legacy and doing what I'm doing too.
Yeah, definitely. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. So tell us first how and why you became a home birth midwife, since you just shared that that was an early part of your journey.
I actually, after my undergraduate, I went and volunteered in Zimbabwe for a year, and I worked with a women's organization there, and an amazing woman. Her name was Emma Mashunge, and she was out in the commercial farms. This was in the 90s in Zimbabwe, and we were doing setting up women's clubs and helping women teach them about HIV and then also income generating skills. But one of the things I kept hearing from women is when they were really, you know, remote on these farms, the struggles with their childbirth. And so when I came back to the U.S., I took a detour. I think I was going to go into international development. Instead, I, you know, got my hands on spiritual midwifery, and I, you know, changed course completely and went to midwifery school. And I thought that home birth midwifery was the right path for me because I knew someday I wanted to return to Africa and work. And I wanted something, you know, low tech, high touch is, you know, how we say it. And
which you have to have, right? Like you have to have. I worked for a month doing maternity care, and then you end up doing, I did pediatrics as a family doctor at the time. That was part of what I did as part of my residency in Haiti. And you have to be, like, I was very able to acclimate to the environment, where some of the OBs and family docs down there who had not had home birth midwifery experience were just, they didn't know what to do without an ultrasound, without a fetal monitor, right? You, like, we have a different set of skills that are really important in the field.
Yes. So that was my path. And then I, you know, practiced for years here in Oregon and had my own family before I later returned to school for medical anthropology and, you know, dove into obstetric fistula work.
And what was it about, right? There's so many things in maternal health and women's health that we can find. There's no shortage. It could be HIV. It could be, I mean, there's a million things. What was it specifically that first got your attention on fistula work and made you say, like, this is where I want to put my time, my energy, my love, my knowledge?
I think one of the most important things about fistula is that it is completely preventable and treatable. So this is a solvable problem. Like, we used to have this problem here in the U.S., and now we don't. Most people, I have to completely explain what a fistula is when I first tell them about my work. And that is, you know, a tribute to the great maternity care. I mean, there's problems with our maternity care system here in the U.S., but we are, you know, women are not suffering from obstetric fistula. So we know that this shouldn't be happening in this day and age anywhere in the world. And the fact that there are so many women in Uganda, where I work, over 100,000 women are estimated suffering from fistula, and that just shouldn't be the case. So devoting myself and my work to a problem that we can fix was really appealing. And then also just the suffering that occurs with fistula, you know, like, it's heartbreaking. And I guess I, you know, wanted to do something for these women.
So to your point that so many women here have never even heard of a fistula and they were like, what is that? Let's break it down. Let's have you explain exactly what it is, what causes it, what happens.
Well, it's a devastating childbirth injury, and that it occurs from the prolonged obstructed labor. And the baby's head is actually kind of compressing the, during that long labor, compressing the soft tissues in the mom's birth canal. And so these labors can go on from like 2 to, I've heard women who are in labor for 6 days. And so during that time, that tissue that is compressed between the baby's head and the pelvic rim of the mom, it loses all blood supply. And once the baby's finally born, that tissue sloughs away and it leaves a hole between either the bladder in the vagina or the rectum in the vagina, or both sometimes. And so through that hole, there's continuous leaking of urine and or feces. And sadly, this is a very difficult labor on the mom, but also the baby. And in 90% of the time, the baby dies during and is born stillbirth. So it's just such a trauma for these women.
And so you mentioned prolonged labors and obstructed labors, and certainly many women listening will have had the experience of the 1 or 2 or 3 day labor that felt like it was never
yes.
ending, and maybe things resolved. Maybe there was pelvic rocking or, you know, Rebozo use or an epidural or a forceps or vacuum extraction or a C-section, but it was resolved. what is it in these other settings that is leading to these prolonged labors without any resolution?
Yeah, that's true. Especially as midwives, we're a little more comfortable with longer labors. But in these cases, one, a lot of the women who experience fistula are actually quite young. And so they might have experienced a lot of malnutrition growing up. And so their pelvis might not be fully developed and ready. You know, we've had girls as young as 12 years old in the hospital with fistula. And Uganda itself, they have one of the highest rates of teenage pregnancy in the world globally. So the smaller pelvis and not really prepared for a pregnancy is one of the contributing factors in the malnutrition. But the other is just the poor maternal health care that's available to them. So they aren't going to have people helping them switch positions and move and change. And then when they finally do need a C-section, that also isn't available to them. They have a really low C-section rate in Uganda, especially in the rural areas where women suffer from fistula. So when a problem is recognized and they were like, okay, now we need a C-section, we need this care. Often the doctor isn't at the hospital, there isn't blood at the hospital, just the oxygen, like all the things you need for a successful cesarean delivery is not available to these women.
And what about traditional birth attendants and their ability to help with these longer, complex, like certainly we know that here in the US as midwives, we do always have the option to get medical care, but we also have things that we know that can sometimes resolve these prolonged labors. Maybe it's baby's head position. Obviously, we're not usually midwifing 12 and 14 year olds at home, so that's a whole different story.
Yeah. One of my first research projects in Uganda was with traditional birth attendants, and it was so fascinating and interesting to sit down and talk with them. In Uganda in 2010, traditional birth attendants were outlawed. And this was part of the government's efforts to get more women to deliver with trained healthcare providers in health facilities. So now, today, most women do deliver in health facilities, the majority of women. There's still home deliveries, of course. But I'd say because of the outlaw and also just the lack of investment, the traditional birth attendants in Uganda have not received a lot of training. And often someone who's called a traditional birth attendant in Uganda, they're just the woman in the village who's had the most babies. So in terms of like having like knowledge passed down over generations, so much of that has been disrupted. It was disrupted by colonialism. It was disrupted by war and political upheaval in Uganda. So that kind of, you know, tradition where, you know, women had this knowledge passed down and they would know what to do in terms of prolonged obstructed labor, it doesn't exist in Uganda the way one would hope.
I saw that quite a bit in Haiti as well. In fact, a lot of the local midwives were the matuan, were actually men. And many of them had cataracts and were arthritic. And it was very interesting and kind of transformative of my somewhat romanticized beliefs, actually. And one of the biggest problems we saw there, which I'm imagining is a very big issue in Uganda, was just lack of transportation, also lack of access to medical facilities in communities, but then also no resources to get a woman who was even a half hour or an hour away. A lot of these women would walk. We would actually note when women came to the hospital how far up their leg the mud went, you know, especially if they had ruptured membranes. We could see from like the fluid leaking and just dirt from the roads accumulating higher and higher up their legs, how far they had walked. Is that also an issue in Uganda, just ruralness and lack of access to transportation to get to places in long labors?
Absolutely. It is a huge problem. I did a maternal health assessment in Uganda in this region, in the eastern region. And, you know, at the district hospital, which is supposed to be like where women are referred to from these health facilities when they need a C-section, the ambulance was sitting there with like no air in the tires, no gas in the tank. Like they, you know, women live really far out. And then also during the rainy season, you know, the roads can be impassable. Like it's a huge problem, the transportation. And sometimes women, that's the delay, is getting money for the ambulance to take them to the regional referral hospital, where there might be another delay before the doctor's there. But they, on their own, will need to raise the money, their family, to put fuel in the ambulance to get them to the main hospital.
Supplements can be an important way to fill the gaps in our nutrition and can sometimes be a missing link in what conventional medicine doesn't have to offer. When it comes to a whole host of health concerns we face as women and mothers, finding supplements we can trust isn't always easy. Studies show us that sometimes what we think we're getting isn't actually what's in the bottle. Enter Fullscript, the company I use to meet my own, my family's, and my patients' supplements needs. With over 300 professional quality products carefully curated to meet our needs from preconception to postpartum, menstrual health to menopause, and our overall wellness, and for products for our children and our partners too. Fullscript attests to the quality of their products, getting you as close as possible to what the products say is on the package. And I'm committed to bringing these to you more affordably. If you use the link avivaram.com/supplements, you'll find an automatic 15% discount on every order. And because my work is mission-driven, I make a percentage of profits available to organizations improving maternal health. Don't worry, you'll find the links in the show notes. Join me in getting better nutritional and herbal supplements for you and yours while doing good for mamas and babies too. Bonnie, I'm curious, with the really young age of girls becoming mothers, is that teenagers in relationship with other teenagers, or is this a country where there's more of a child bride, if you will, situation happening, or both? Or is there sexual assault resulting in pregnancies?
All three. Absolutely. So that young 12-year-old case was sexual assault. And I have seen very young brides, girls married off, especially if their parents have died, then family members, you know, will arrange a marriage for them. And then also teenage pregnancy in relation with other teenagers. That's a little older though.
And so I shared just in my intro a little bit of some of the devastating impact, but I think it's really important to bring this to life. I just remember watching Walk to Beautiful, which was set in Ethiopia, and the walk was to the hospital in Addis. That was sort of it was an allegory of the journey. Just women forced to live on the edges of town in huts that they had put together themselves. The odors as a risk for attracting animals. I mean, just so many layers upon layers of isolation, often their children becoming kind of outcast because they were living with the mothers. It's so dire. And I wonder if you can bring to life some of why this issue is so important. I mean, the sheer numbers of women going through this, but what are they really going through?
It is dire. You're absolutely right. It's heartbreaking. So often the women themselves don't understand why they're leaking, and also their families and the community don't understand. I've talked to many women who were sent home from the hospital. They had realized they're leaking and they were told, oh, it'll clear up in a few days, you know. And so then they go home and it's not clearing up. They'll try multiple ways to get treatment, but they don't really understand. They're not given a diagnosis, which I think that in itself is a tragedy. But then because of the odor, and they're living, you know, they're living in villages and in huts without running water. There's no laundry, you know, soap's expensive. So they often are built a solitary hut on the edge of the property and live on their own, you know, away from the family. They don't eat with the family, which that women talk about that all the time, like how hard that was for them to spend all this time alone. It's a very lonely disease. And I think, you know, all of us, we've experienced loneliness at some times, but like every day, you know, people just don't want to be near them. In Uganda, many of the women are divorced or abandoned by their husbands, and they're sent back to their parents or their family. If they did have children in Uganda, the children are part, it's more of a patriarchal line, and they stay with the father and the father's family. And so then they're also separated from their older children, which, as you can imagine, you know, they've just lost a baby and, you know, suffered this horrible injury, and now they're separated from their husband and their children.
And these are countries where women are often dependent on being married for survival, for shelter, for food, for...
Absolutely. And their ability to produce children. That's what they're valued for, sadly.
And, you know, I think for me, the scene in A Walk to Beautiful, that was the most poignant for me. In some ways, there was a woman who was getting on a bus to go to the fistula repair clinic. And when we talk about urine leaking and we talk about feces leaking, there is no control over it coming out. So this woman was sitting on the bus with just a puddle of urine trickling down her legs and puddling, you know, at her feet. Of course, nobody wanted to sit next to her, and her shame was so apparent. But this is also, as in so many countries, it's not just lack of access to sanitary products, it's lack of access to adult diapers, anything to contain. So women end up using old rags. Can you talk a little bit about the complexities of this? Because I really want women who are listening to us to really understand, we're not talking about like you're jumping on your trampoline and you leak a little pee. This is like,
right,
can be zero control of urine containment or stool containment.
You're completely right. The women, you know, they don't have access to any sanitary products or hide the leaking, but then that also creates a lot of odor. All that cloth up against their skin creates sores. So, and then at night when they're sleeping, their mattress gets wet. So they'll have grass mattress and that gets wet with urine or feces. And they just have to live that way day in and day out. It's a very isolating, embarrassing, they're full of shame. Most of the women consider suicide at some point. That was one of the really tragic things I discovered in doing the research when I sat down with these women and, you know, heard their stories. It's, you know, they just didn't want to go on living. It was that bad. It destroyed their lives.
And are women finding each other and talking with each other? Did they realize they're not alone?
No, many of these women are really isolated because it's not that prevalent of a disease. So they might be, you know, the only woman in their village who are suffering from this. This is one of the beautiful things about the hospital is that once the patients are all there together, the women, that alone is healing for them to hear, to find out that they weren't alone, that this wasn't their fault, that there are other women, you know, that have been suffering from this. And that sisterhood just develops in the hospital, which you can see like their face, you know, everything about them becomes lighter. They're like, oh, this wasn't my fault. These, and they're sharing stories and helping each other heal from the pain. It's really quite beautiful once they, the realization that they are not alone.
So tell us about Terwode. What does it mean? How did you found it? What is it doing? So, what are the obstacles? What is, tell us all the things. It's incredible.
Terwode was founded in Uganda in 1999 by Alice Amasu, and she is just a powerhouse and a true visionary. And she, for years, she put together an amazing team of women, and for years they were working on helping women access treatment in local government hospitals. And those are mainly done through fistula surgical camps. So it'd be like a 2-week camp where they would do radio ads and kind of some outreach, and a bunch of women would show up to get surgery. But over the years, they realized, one, women were waiting for care way too long because these camps were held so sporadically. And to the quality of care in these camps, you know, there were, it's just not a injury that can be healed that quickly. And you know, a lot of times there are complications that women need more additional care, and that wasn't available in these camps. And the women weren't treated with the nurturing care that Alice and her team thought they should be. So their dream became to create their own hospital, similar to the Hamlin Hospital in Ethiopia. And I worked with Alice in Uganda in 2011 and 2012. I moved there for a winter with my family, my two young boys. They were 8 and 11. And we totally bought into this dream. You know, it really changed the course of my life. I came back to the U.S. and within a few years, I founded Terwode Women's Fund. And so we are the U.S.-based nonprofit, and our mission is to support Terwode in their work to end fistula in Uganda. So we are long-term partners, and we like stand in solidarity with Terwode in fighting fistula in Uganda.
So what are the stages of repairing fistula that women go through? And it's not just the repair, but this reintegration. And, you know, how does their community welcome them back after they've been ostracized for so long?
One of the good things about fistula is that it is treatable. So that with surgery, about 90% of women can be successfully repaired and their continence completely restored. So that is amazing. And that is one of the things that, you know, we work so hard is to make sure women have access to the surgical care. But the other part is healing from the trauma of therapy. So when Terwode, all the years that they were working to help women access treatment in the public hospitals, they started realizing that treatment alone wasn't, the women were still ostracized often in their community, and they also still carried this heavy burden of shame. I mean, I think in the U.S. we've learned so much more recently about trauma and how it affects us. And so I think we can all imagine what the impact of this on women. And so they developed a holistic reintegration program. This is a 2-week program, and they provide individual counseling, group counseling. They provide education. For some women, this is really when they learn why they suffered from the fistula and how it can be prevented. They become, you know, safe motherhood advocates, and they learn all of, you know, they're educated on safe motherhood. They also get legal rights. So they return to their community as advocates for improved maternal health. And then the last part is the economic empowerment. So they teach microfinance skills and help them form savings clubs, but they also do income generating skills training. So these women, they have been so impoverished by fistula and just pushed really deep into poverty. And so when they return to their communities, now they have a skill and they can start their own business and just really feel empowered in their new life with their fistulas healed. It's really like a transformation. They return and they have their dignity back and they're empowered and confident again. So that's a really beautiful part of the healing journey.
Yeah, that's incredible. I'm so curious for women who have been more aggressively shunned by a now former husband or parents. Do these women, are they able to return home and not let go of anger? I'm not exactly even sure what the emotion would be, but are they able to feel part of their families again? Or is there just a lingering, hey, I was in need and you totally rejected me, and now I need a different community and a different place and way to be?
I would say there's some of both, but I'd say in most cases, they are able to repair the family. Terwode will bring the family and the husband actually to the hospital, or they'll all go to the community and do counseling. And I'm amazed at how forgiving these women are and how much they can just move on with their life. It's something I've learned. I've learned so much from these women, like their resiliency. It's stunning to me. And yeah, like what they've endured, and then how they can sit there and laugh and smile with me and just be grateful for, you know, the small things in life. It's been a true learning and beautiful lessons for me, and the forgiveness. But then there are some families that it has, you know, gender-based violence also is a part of fistula. And there are some times when Terwode and the women realize it's not safe to return to that community or to that marriage, you know, we'll help them relocate, you know, somewhere else where they might have a sister or an auntie or someone. Or another beautiful thing about the hospital is that they employ caretakers at the hospital that were former fistula survivors. And so these are women that either live nearby the hospital or for whatever reason couldn't return to their community. And so now they're employed and they actually get to be part of helping other women heal from fistula.
That's so beautiful. And who are the healthcare workers that are providing the surgical support?
We have 3 Ugandan doctors who are at different levels of training. So there's a quite intensive training program for fistula surgeons. And then we have Terwode hires all local clinicians from Uganda. One of the things about Uganda that's unique is there's 40 local languages. I think actually over 40 local languages. So one of the things that...
Wow.
Yeah, it's really, it's complex.
It is wild.
And so one of the things Alice and her team do is they hire nurses that can speak, I mean, they all speak many languages, but they try to get people speaking all the different languages. So there's always a translator when women come from very remote areas. Someone can communicate to her in her language, which is also really comforting to the women to have everything explained in their local language.
One of the things that we hear about, and I certainly talk about in the U.S., is the overuse of cesarean section as a major risk factor for maternal health, right? And then we have places like Uganda or where I worked in Haiti, and I think you've worked in Haiti too.
Yes.
So you know the conditions there.
Yeah.
Another, again, deeply medically under-resourced country. And the World Health Organization is actually pretty clear on this, right? There's like a range of sort of 15 to 19% C-section access being the sweet spot where we go over 19% and it actually has diminishing returns for mom and mom and baby as a dyad, and which we have here in the U.S. with rates as high as, well, average of 34%. But then you mentioned in Uganda, just a complete lack of access to C-section or significant lack, especially in rural areas. I'm so curious for you as a midwife who has worked in Uganda and in Haiti and in the U.S., like what are some of the parallels and the differences that you see in these contexts, and any kind of universal lessons about how we think about birth, why birth isn't safer for mothers everywhere, and what we can do to make birth safer, both in these over and under-resourced? It's a big question, so you take it where you want to go.
Well, I think one of the things has been on my mind a lot lately is just the lack, it's reproductive justice, you know? So in Uganda, you know, mothers and children, there's, you know, so much talk about how they are valued. But then when you see where's the money to care for these women in the hospital, where's the maternal health care? It's just not there. And so that's a reproductive justice issue. And then here in the U.S., we are seeing that, you know, so it's women's like ability to make choices for themselves, but also the Black maternal health crisis here in the U.S. I mean, that's just stunning and that shouldn't be happening. I listened to your wonderful interview with Sharon Malone in April, and she was talking about Michelle Broder and her work in Alabama with Anarcha, Lucy, and Betsy and those statues. So those women, actually, they were slave women who had obstetric fistula. So the surgical experiments they were doing without anesthesia, it was fistula. And so these are, you know, long-standing problems that have occurred here in the U.S. And then we continue not to invest in the U.S. You know, if there was a true investment in maternity and reproductive justice here in the U.S., there'd be paid maternity leave. Like, you have a baby, you should have some time off to take care of that baby and bond with that baby. And so we don't see the investment here in the U.S. and the prioritization. And we also don't see it in places like Uganda and many countries in the world, sadly.
And, you know, I should clarify too, that even though we do have a rampant overuse of C-section and other obstetric interventions in this country, and that's really so profit driven, we have entire states in this country in what the so-called Black Belt, you know, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, et cetera, where there are hundreds of counties combined that have zero maternal health, no hospital, no OB, no family physician who's doing obstetrics. So we do have these incredible, there's a term that Leah Penniman of Soul Fire Farm first introduced me to, which is rather than saying food deserts, we say food apartheid. And I've started using the term, and I don't know if anyone else is using the term, but I just, it slipped out recently, and I've now started to say medical apartheid. We do have medical apartheid in the United States, which isn't entirely dissimilar. I mean, the disparities of the levels of poverty in a place like Haiti or Uganda are unique and specific, but we have significant poverty and significant lack of access to care here, and it's very racialized and very biased.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's shocking and it's shameful.
It is shameful. I heard I'm not going to name names, but I was at a meeting and I heard the president of one of this country's major hospital systems say that the maternal morbidity and mortality rates in the United States should be the most shameful thing we recognize about American healthcare and about our culture in general. This was so profound.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Yeah. So I co-founded Terrebonne Women's Fund in 2014, and our first goal was to help Alice and her team raise money for a dedicated fishula hospital in Uganda. And so I'm happy to say we're successful, and the hospital opened in 2019. It's a beautiful facility in eastern Uganda, and this last year, 2023, we celebrated 1,000 patients treated, so 1,000 women and girls whose lives have been completely transformed and restored, and their dignity restored. So it's really an amazing hospital with holistic patient-centered care. You know, I talked about the sisterhood that develops, but also the Terrebonne team, they put the women and girls that they treat at the center of all of their decisions. So it's such an amazing healing space. They also have the first and only physical therapy program for women suffering from fistula and pelvic floor disorders. So yeah, it's pretty amazing, and we're very proud of this hospital.
And how does it stay funded now?
So that's where we come in here in the U.S. Like, I saw, you know, raising money in Uganda is really hard, and this was part of the reason I started a nonprofit here in the U.S. is because I believe this issue is so important, and I know that when I tell people about it here in the U.S., you know, they also want to help. And so we fundraise here in the U.S. and raise awareness. And then we practice trust philanthropy with Terrebonne, where we are, you know, very trusting, transparent partners and supporting them in their work. And so that's how all the funding, none of the patient care is completely free of charge. And so everything from the transportation, the meals, the surgical care, the reintegration program, the patients don't have to pay for any of that care. It's all supported by donations from here in the U.S. and also from a few other places around the world.
Is this your full-time work now?
Yeah. Yeah, it is my full-time work now.
It is. And is it a team of you, or do you have a team?
It's a team of me. I have a very active board. I have a few consultants, and we've been really successful the last few years, though. So we're hoping to grow. So it might not always be a team of just me.
And for those who are listening who would want to get involved in helping to support your work, how could they do that?
We have a website, TewodeWomensFund.org. And on there, you know, we have a lot of ways to get involved. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can fill out a form to get in touch and volunteer. And then most importantly, I'd say you can donate. A full cost for a surgery is $1,200. So a lot of people donate monthly, and some of them who can afford it donate $100 a month. And in a year, they support a full cost of a surgery for a woman and girl. One of our board members pointed out that that's less than the cost of a latte each day. So that's kind of amazing. But we have people give, I'd say most of our donors give small amounts, and that really supports the work. So you can look on our LinkedIn and our YouTube. We have some videos also of the work and patients that we've worked with in Uganda. So that's another place that they can find us. Did I already say Facebook and Instagram?
And so we'll make sure to put all the information in the show notes so that everyone can find you and find Terwode Support Fund. Can you also just tell us, for those people who are like, I'm feeling like doing something right this second and I don't have a minute to go to show notes, what can they do? If they're just like, I want to donate right now.
Go right to our website, TewodeWomensFund.org, and there's a donate button right on that homepage. That would be wonderful.
So it's TerreWode.
Yes, Terwode, and that's exactly right, TewodeWomensFund.org.
So Bonnie, we've talked so much about this really devastating problem, and even though I know you said it's rare in the sense that it may be only one woman in her village, but actually cumulatively, it's not rare. It's really significant. And clearly, you and I know as midwives, as women, prevention is always the goal, not just repair. In fact, if we could do more prevention, that would be incredible on every level. So what are the efforts that are being done and what can be done, especially in these rural communities, to prevent fistula?
Yeah, prevention is the key. I mean, if we don't prevent fistula, this hospital is going to be running for years repairing fistula. So actually, we're in a very exciting time for Terwode Women's Community Hospital. We are starting to plan for phase two of the hospital, which is a maternal center of excellence. So it'll be a full maternity hospital that, you know, starts with high quality prenatal care all the way through postpartum, and importantly, really high quality and timely C-sections for women that need it. The other wonderful thing about, you know, phase two, this Terwode maternity, will be that we are envisioning it as a training center. So we want to bring up the quality of care in the whole region. And so bring in clinicians from some of these rural health facilities and kind of upskill them, provide them additional training and some simulation training. So the idea is not just to create one high quality maternity center, but to bring up the level of care and show what can be done in terms of providing excellent care in Uganda.
Amazing.
Thank you.
I'm really just so grateful you're doing this work and really excited to hear how it evolves over time and just to look at those fistula numbers going down. I mean, this sounds like has the potential to be incredibly impactful. Bonnie, you have followed your inner voice and created a path that is not the average traveled path. You became a home birth midwife. You reinvented yourself with medical anthropology as an add-on when you felt like you wanted and were inspired to know more. You went to Uganda. I'm so curious, two things. What is it that allows you or inspires you to have that confidence in your inner voice and follow that? And then there's a question I ask all my guests, which is, if you could tell your younger self anything, how old would she be and what would you tell her? So kind of the amalgamation of that, like you're following your inner voice. How do you know to do that?
You know, I have written on my board here in my office, how can I be of most service in the world? And that is kind of my guiding light in life, is I really want to be of service and help create a better, healthier world for people. And so that's my North Star. And then my younger self, you're right, my path has not been straightforward. And I think I would, you know, tell her that that's going to be okay. It's going to work out. It's going to be curvy. You're not going to always know where you're going, but you're going to meet fellow travelers who, you know, want to join you on this path, and it will ultimately be beautiful.
Well, I'm with you on service being the North Star. I have a beautiful, I'll pick it up for when we have video, but it's a beautiful gift that was given to me. And it's just kind of like the New York symbol with the, you know, the I love New York, but it says give with the heart for the V.
Oh, I love that.
And I keep this right front and center on my desk, and service and following a path, kind of carving our own path in a way, right? Is something we both share in common. And
yeah,
I see the light and shine in your face of the give back that the work gives you.
Absolutely.
So thank you for that. So everyone, this has been a journey into perhaps a topic that you have never heard of before. And I hope it's been expansive. And I hope that in hearing Bonnie's story, if there's something close to your heart that you're also inspired to give into or be part of or serve, that you trust that. There's a beautiful quote by Rumi. It's one of my favorite quotes. And that is, whatever you're seeking is also seeking you. So trusting in that inspiration. And it may not be that you have to move to a foreign country and change your whole life or go back to school, but there may be small local ways that you feel like there's something you want to contribute to. And then we don't use this podcast per se as a fundraiser, but we do often have folks on who are creating incredible things and incredible change in the world, and they're bootstrapping it and can use our support. So I know that we will be making a contribution to Terra Vuole, and we welcome and invite you to go to the website and to, if you can, if it's one latte a day's worth or more, it's a cause worthy of contributing to, because a small amount really can change women's lives. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that when we change one woman's life, the ripple effect is exponential and uncountable. So thank you all for being here. Thank you, Bonnie, again, for being with me and for doing all that you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
And see you next time, everybody, on Health. Air has got me down, gonna lift it up. Air has got me down, gonna lift it up. I hope you enjoyed this episode, that it helped you to feel seen and heard, and perhaps that it even brought you some aha moments. Please share the love by sharing this with a friend or someone in your life who could benefit from the kinds of things we talk about in this space. Also, make sure to follow me on Instagram at dr.avivaram and go to avivaram.com to join the conversation about the show on my blog. While you're there, you can sign up for my free newsletter with tips on taking back your health. Be sure to leave a rating and a review for the podcast and follow the podcast to be notified of new episodes every week. Can't wait to see you next time.